My name is Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, and I'm a medical doctor and co-author of a book called Dissolving Illusions. Up until 2011, I worked in the conventional medical system as an internist and nephrologist. Kidneys are fascinating and complicated organs, without which your blood, bones, lungs, heart, and brain won't function normally. Because of that, kidneys are really important. I want to tell you some of the things that occurred during my medical career, starting near the beginning. I set my sights on a series of goals. The university degree came first, then a 2-year stint in a cell biology lab. And then, because I wanted to work with humans, I went to medical school. On June 1, 1993, I started a residency in New York City, 1 month before the National Institutes of Health held an international workshop on current issues on vaccination, a topic that was nowhere on my radar. The published summaries and abstracts from the weekend in July reveals what some of the participants were studying. Discussions of the primitive level of the science of adjuvants, of vaccine contaminants, and unexpected adverse reactions. Interference in the normal immunologic response as a result of vaccination, shedding of revertant virulent polioviruses after vaccination, as well as dreams of future combination vaccines and new delivery systems. In 1989, I had a series of hepatitis B vaccines, after which I was unwell for some time, but never connected the dots, because all I had been taught about vaccines was that they were the greatest contribution to public health ever. After the residency, I completed a nephrology specialty in Philadelphia, then became an assistant professor of medicine, teaching various levels of doctors and students, and later moved on to a private practice in a large teaching hospital. I sat and listened to doctors who said things like, "Paul Offit says that 10,000 vaccines can theoretically be given all at once to babies, and anti-vaccine people are a threat to human survival, and aluminum is important for the growth of a healthy fetus." So those are my academic qualifications. Today, in 2015, my critics find it easier to ignore my scientific degrees and CV and choose to sneer me down by saying, "She's a quack homeopath." So let's clarify the issue. There's no denying that some people heal under the care of homeopathy. I did attend the School of Homeopathy in the United Kingdom from 2008 until 2011 while still in full-time medical practice. However, I did not complete my studies and never earned a degree. I am not and do not wish to be a homeopath. While I loved many aspects of homeopathic theory and study, homeopathy didn't work in my hands as a practitioner in training. I have no regret in doing it during my quest to broaden my understanding of disease and healing in order to give my patients something more. I do hold a bachelor's degree in physics. I am a physicist and have used physics. I am an internist and a nephrologist, and have taught medical students, residents, and fellows in training. Yet strangely, the critics zero in on something I'm not even involved in and call me a quack homeopath. I find it amusing that skeptics rarely let the truth get in the way of their delusions. Back to my real world as a newly trained doctor. Little did I know that what I was taught about vaccines and immunity meant that I had absolutely no idea what I was talking about and left me blinded when confronted with the real world. And this is still the case for the majority of medical professionals today who are at the front line of patient care. I knew nothing about vaccine manufacture, contents, risks, or history. We had been told historical factoids about Jonas Salk inventing one polio vaccine and Albert Sabin the other, and that smallpox and polio were supposedly eradicated by vaccination. I certainly knew nothing about the developing immune system. After being handed the schedule of vaccines for kids during my pediatric rotations, I was told to give them on time. That was the extent of my knowledge. As a nephrologist, I gave hepatitis B vaccines to dialysis patients. Their immune systems don't respond very well, so we often had to give them numerous injections of high-dose vaccine, which is an enormous aluminum load. I gave flu shots, pneumonia shots, all per dialysis protocol, never considering any potential problems. Nothing was linked to vaccines in my mind until one patient in 2009 volunteered to me. I was fine until I had that flu shot. And I thought, well, that can't be. But the other doctors and I could find no alternative cause. Until 2009, I had never once considered vaccines as a potential threat to kidney health. This was my sentinel case. a man who had normal kidneys documented by blood work prior to December, then was vaccinated in his doctor's office and came to the hospital in renal shutdown 2 weeks later. He required dialysis for about 3 weeks and then was taken off of dialysis, but his kidney function only returned to about 70%. I want to show you a sampling of some other cases that I made record of after that first eye-opening event, when I began to ask the simple question, when was your last vaccine? This 69-year-old man had documented normal kidney function prior to getting his swine flu shot mid-December and developed kidney failure. He stopped making urine and had dangerously high potassium levels and acid buildup within 4 weeks. He was placed on dialysis and died 1 month later after having a massive stroke. Then another man came along with normal kidney function. He got an H1N1 and seasonal flu vaccine in mid-December 2009 and came to the hospital about 4 weeks later with severe nephrosis, losing massive amounts of protein from his urine. His kidney filtering capacity was also down by about 20% from his former baseline. He was treated by me for 2 years with heavy-hitting immunosuppressive medicines without much improvement at all. On discussing my cases at our practice, my colleague pulled this file from 2005 to show me. She had normal kidneys, got a flu shot in October of 2005, and developed an acute illness on the day of injection. She started dialysis 5 days later, underwent several dialysis treatments, and then regained kidney function, but as of 2009 had only about 40% of normal kidney function. This 56-year-old man had normal kidneys, then got a seasonal and H1N1 shot as separate shots in December. 4 days later, he developed nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. On January 1st, his kidneys were totally shut down and he started dialysis. He continued for 11 days and then was able to come off, but only regained about 80% of his former kidney function. Well, this might not seem like a big deal, but having a large dialysis catheter placed into the internal jugular vein and getting 11 days worth of dialysis with all the inflammation that dialysis causes in the body really is a big deal. Add to that the drugs and chemicals required during and between dialysis treatments, and the costs are hundreds of thousands of dollars each time this happens. Because of seeing several patients with kidney failure after outpatient vaccines, I started looking at what happened in the hospital after vaccines. This is a patient who had mild renal impairment and was admitted for an unrelated issue. He was given the quadruple strength flu vaccine for the over 65 age group on the fourth hospital day. On the graph, you'll see it is denoted there as 9/25. He developed kidney failure within 24 hours, and I was consulted at that time. It took several months for his kidneys to settle back down, but they only returned to about 60% of his former baseline. This woman had a ruptured intestine. She was operated on and did well postoperatively. Then 5 days later, she was given two vaccines, one for influenza and one for pneumococcus, upon which her kidney shut down and she was started on dialysis. She regained about 60% of her kidney function and was discharged to the rehabilitation service, only to return a few weeks later with new onset seizures. She died in the hospital. As nephrologists, our patient base is typically one of very serious illness, often with numerous comorbidities. So when dealing with these people, there's always that question mark. Are we just seeing the anomalies of a constantly sick population base? Well, that question was answered when I thought back to a situation a year or so previous when I had taken care of two healthy people who were told vaccinations were a necessary part of hospital employment. One lady was hired in the kitchen and had a severe glomerulonephritis after the varicella or chickenpox vaccine. The other lady also had a severe glomerulonephritis after the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. The MMR vaccine-injured employee was still on dialysis in 2011 when I left. She was doing quite poorly after being otherwise healthy with no known medical problems. To begin with, I thought that it was an unfortunate thing, one of those one-in-a-million cases that we hear about. But as the numbers of patients who said to me, "I was fine until I had that vaccine," increased, I got concerned. Then, after the swine flu vaccine was introduced as policy on admission to the hospital, which often confused my ability to diagnose the problems they were admitted with, more questions filled my head. So that was what I saw with my own two eyes and what my own patients were telling me. Any other time a drug was even a possibility for causing a kidney problem, there was no resistance by my colleagues to stopping that drug. Kidneys are so important that you never take a chance with them unless a life is in immediate jeopardy. Hospital-acquired acute kidney failure carries a 50% mortality rate. The answer seems simple, doesn't it? Don't vaccinate sick people in the hospital. Knowing that I would not be able to stop the vaccines altogether in hospital patients, I simply placed a do not vaccinate order on my patient charts with kidney disease, whom I was consulted upon. I asked the administration to delay vaccines until discharge day. Doesn't this seem reasonable? Well, little did I know. In 2001, I was idealistic and naive. I thought that those involved in policymaking, especially the ones whom I knew for years, would want to do what is best for patients over and above what policy dictated. How wrong I was. The hospital policy was to vaccinate as many patients as possible on the first hospital day. A pharmacist would go into the patient's room, show them one sheet of paper from the Centers for Disease Control with limited and biased information, and offer them two or more vaccines. If the patient consented, which most did, an order was put into the computer with the attending physician's name, often before the doctor had even seen the patient or a diagnosis had even been made, and the nurse would give that vaccine. Sometimes the order had my name on it, even though I would not have ordered the vaccine. I was not happy, and I decided to speak to the hospital management about what I was seeing. One day in the corridor, I bumped into the chief of medicine. He asked me how things were going, and I detailed my concerns to him. And according to him, I was the only doctor seeing these problems. He kept responding as if the science was settled. I got the full-on historic justification. Oh, but vaccines have eradicated smallpox, polio, meningitis, as if that had any relevance to vaccinating sick adults, some of whom were at death's door in the hospital. So I put my concerns in writing, and meetings were held to discuss the issue, but I wasn't invited to those meetings. The result? I was told that acutely ill inpatients would continue to be offered vaccines on arrival at the hospital. I asked myself, exactly what is the science that says that these vaccines are safe for really sick people? There must be studies on the subject and writings in the medical literature in order for these doctors to be so sure of the rightness of their policy. After all, it's science we're talking about, isn't it? And the science is supposed to be all settled on the safety and effectiveness of vaccines. Because the hospital policies were centered on flu and pneumonia vaccines, this was where my research started. I submitted a written report to the administration. In my research, I found that aluminum in vaccines is a documented cause of granuloma formation, something I had been familiar with for years. Aluminum is in the following vaccines: DTaP, some HIB, pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, hepatitis B, all combination DTaP, HIB, Tdap, or hepatitis B vaccines, hepatitis A vaccines, and human papillomavirus vaccines. Aluminum and mercury given together have synergistic toxicity. My patients who received flu shots and pneumonia shots would have received both. Can patients be assured that their renal, interstitial, granulomatous, or autoimmune illness is not due to the aluminum or molecular mimicry from a previous vaccine? Moreover, I found that my patient population with acute and chronic illness had barely been tested for vaccine efficacy, safety, or long-term consequences. So the answer, of course, is no. Patients cannot be assured of safety. Some documented ill effects of vaccines upon kidneys include autoimmune kidney disease, vasculitis, thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, and aluminum-mediated granulomatous issues. So I discussed all this evidence for over a year with the administration and with my various colleagues. Other doctors were starting to change their previously set minds, and a high number of nurses were catching on. But then, because the hospital administration could not rebut my arguments, they called upon an expert to set me straight. He never addressed any of my questions regarding acute kidney patients or acutely ill new admissions. He gave me a list of studies showing that some vaccines raise antibody levels in most immunosuppressed people with HIV or kidney failure. His argument was that ipso facto, for acutely ill kidney patients with sepsis, heart attacks, Guillain-Barré syndrome, cancer, urinary tract obstruction, nephrosis, and so on, vaccines were also perfectly safe. His letter was quite bizarre. I kept thinking, and this is the expert? Why can't he answer my specific concerns? Where is his proof that side effects don't happen to my patients? Nowhere could I find studies that looked at vaccines in acutely ill patients commonly seen by nephrologists. Even my pro-vaccine colleagues agreed that there was no scientific basis to give these injections so quickly upon admission, and they supported my motion to have the policy changed to vaccinate on discharge day. At the same time, the hospital turned up the heat on me. My progress notes and hospital charts were reviewed, which was something totally new to me. Nobody had ever before challenged my integrity or my patient care. I was then told by the administration that in order to support my outrageous claims, I should do my own study, a chart review study. I should submit it for peer review in order to prove it. But aside from doing one's own study, where would you initially go for case histories? Where I had just been, the medical literature, right? When I referred dozens of published case histories and expert peer-reviewed opinions to the hospital administration, I was told by the consultant that case reports in minor journals mean nothing. And even in major journals, case histories are just anecdotal. In his letter, the expert criticized my citation of non-American journals and that of my 47 medical references, one was from a Japanese journal. He insinuated that my argument about what I was seeing in my hospital was invalid because I searched the world's literature in order to make my point. He said that because there was no published data sets showing influenza vaccines caused kidney ailments, that my suggestion to exercise caution vaccinating acutely ill patients was unwarranted. The executive committee of my hospital also told me that it was not appropriate for me to stop vaccination orders on my patients and that I was confusing the nursing staff. I thought, how bizarre. Nurses are never used to the same treatment plan for all patients, ever. My experience was not one of confusing nurses at all, but of finding other vaccination-critical people on the hospital staff who agreed with me. Among the nursing staff, there were more allies than I would have ever imagined. Furthermore, the hospital administration argued that evidence for benefit of vaccination is overwhelmingly positive and evidence from harm is negligible. Nobody in the hospital ever addressed my specific arguments. All I got was sound bites. Vaccines are safe and effective. Smallpox was eradicated by vaccines. Polio was eliminated by vaccines. After I left the hospital, this article by Dugal came out, as have several others which implicate flu shots in the genesis of autoimmune and vasculitic diseases. But in 2011, I didn't have this article. Even if I had put this in front of the executive committee of the hospital, their attitude was that the science was settled. Case reports mean nothing. Dugal's co-author told me personally that she is now taking vaccine histories on all her renal patients. All doctors should do the same. But it's rarely done because doctors have no idea about the immunology and toxicology involved in vaccinating. Dugal was saying what I had seen with my own eyes and reported to the administration, that an increase in autoimmune disease activity has been described after influenza vaccination, and he recommended careful assessment of the risk-to-benefit ratio, which I had done, yet the hospital overrode me and my expertise. Apparently, once a policy is established, professional opinion doesn't matter. Let's look at the cases Dugal described. The last two cases here are his, and the other ones are from the medical literature. There are patients with vasculitis involving the brain, lungs, kidneys, and intestines within weeks of vaccination, some of whom developed new diseases and some whom simply relapsed. Patients with vasculitis and underlying autoimmunity are not informed of the known risk to them in vaccinating. Instead, they're persuaded and reassured that the benefit outweighs the supposedly small risk and usually believe that the doctor knows best. Note the pattern here, though. Kidney failure 2 to 4 weeks after injection, requiring highly toxic drugs to treat these vasculitides. These were things I was seeing happen to some of my patients after vaccination in the past, And today I get messages from parents all over the world telling me how their child's kidneys became diseased after vaccines. And just last month, I got a note from a woman whose spouse with kidney disease, who was very stable, died at home one day after receiving two vaccines. She was extremely distressed, and I had no comforting words for her. Since leaving the hospital in 2011, more literature has been published besides Dugall that supports my hypothesis and my experience that common and difficult to treat kidney diseases can be caused and worsened by vaccine ingredients. This 2011 New England Journal of Medicine article titled "Early Childhood Membranous Nephropathy Due to Cationic Bovine Serum Albumin" details the association between circulating cationic bovine, meaning cow, serum albumin and a very difficult to treat form of kidney disease called idiopathic membranous nephropathy. Membranous nephropathy is a serious condition of the kidney filters in pediatrics and is more common in adults. Long-term prognosis is unknowable for certain, but approximately 50% of patients develop progressive kidney disease. The authors must be aware that they hit upon a very touchy subject since they implicate immunization in the body of the article, but conclude by simply saying, if bovine serum albumin is detected in kidney biopsy specimens, eliminating it from the diet could be beneficial. What the authors don't say is that eliminating direct injection of bovine serum albumin at the same time as injecting aluminum adjuvant may be beneficial in preventing the susceptible child or adult from developing this type of kidney disease. The following list of BSA-containing vaccines could possibly be very problematic to some people. BSA is used to feed the live animal or human cells that propagate the virus or bacteria during vaccine culture production. The implications of this article, in my opinion, are enormous in terms of potential adverse responses to vaccines that contain bovine serum albumin, but also to aluminum, viral, and bacterial antigens. How much adult or childhood nephrotic syndrome is caused by vaccine ingredients? The issue isn't addressed in medical literature. What clinicians see doesn't necessarily count. And how many of these vaccines are given at the same time? Often 8 vaccines are given at once to children at 1 year of age, most of which contain bovine serum albumin and aluminum, which, by the way, is added to enhance the inflammatory properties of the vaccine to the vaccine antigens. Here are the aluminum-containing ones. The asterisk at the bottom indicates overlap of bovine serum albumin and aluminum. There is plenty of writing in the medical literature about how one-size-fits-all vaccine programs give variable results even in healthy people, and how they can trigger serious inflammation and autoimmunity. There's more reason, in my opinion, to believe vaccines are not only dangerous, but also less effective in sick people. For instance, one day when I was on rounds, I went in to check on someone who was having plasmapheresis, which is a procedure designed to remove antibodies from the blood. He had kidney failure, and when I saw he had just received an influenza vaccine, I was astounded, and I said to my colleagues and the referring physician who was with me, "Can you see the problem with this?" Well, everyone found somewhere else to look. Around the same time, I went in to see a 27-year-old young man with lymphoma and acute kidney failure who was in the middle of a chemotherapy infusion. And in front of him was the pink CDC information sheet for the flu shot and the pneumococcal vaccine, which he had just consented to. I said to him, "Have they given the vaccine to you yet?" And he said, "No." So I immediately canceled the vaccination order. These two incidents typify the events which were occurring at the time and were the clinical issues that set me on today's divergent path. If someone had just used logic and agreed with me that you don't vaccinate critically ill patients and accepted the evidence in front of their own eyes that the vaccines were causing problems, then maybe I would still be at the hospital today. When you've walked away from people you really care about and a job you've loved, it's only natural that you would review the situation and ask questions like, could I have found more information which would have stopped very sick people from being vaccinated shortly after being wheeled into the hospital? I started thinking back to things that are crucial in nephrology, like water. In every dialysis unit, there's one person employed whose main job is water maintenance. He came in earliest every day to make sure the dialysis water didn't have anything toxic, including aluminum in it. The tanks were cleaned out frequently, and the water was kept very pure. Why? Because aluminum is known to be dangerous for patients on dialysis. Why? Because the gut excretes most orally ingested aluminum, but the minute you bypass the gut with aluminum injections, aluminum causes big problems in kidney patients. In the past, the water used for dialysis contained enough aluminum to cause problems. We used to, and in some cases still do, use oral medicines in dialysis patients that contain aluminum. Even though aluminum via the gut is safer, we don't like doing it. A person with good kidneys can get rid of most of the absorbed aluminum, but our kidney patients can't. However, if the phosphate levels threaten a dialysis patient's health, oral aluminum will bind and excrete it, but the patient may retain some of that aluminum because of compromised kidney function. So here we were taking all of the aluminum out of the water and shifting away from aluminum-containing phosphate binders as much as we could, but we were willing to inject these people with aluminum-containing vaccines. For instance, two rounds of hepatitis B injections, which may not even have a protective effect, will have 3,000 micrograms of aluminum in it. So what are some of the problems known to be caused by injected aluminum? Aluminum is a neurotoxin that inhibits more than 200 biologically important functions and causes various adverse effects in plants, animals, and humans. All those years, I knew what a great binder aluminum was for phosphate in the gut, but I never thought that it could be a problem for the major energy molecule in the body called adenosine triphosphate, but it is. We know this as nephrologists, but somehow it's considered impossible for aluminum in vaccines to be able to do anything other than stimulate the immune system. We're very careful as nephrologists when treating babies. Why? Because the kidney function of babies isn't the same as adults. It's vastly reduced. But when it comes to vaccines, this reduced kidney function in infants is always left out of the discussion. Have a look at the range of normal kidney function in term babies. It's even lower for premature babies. So I looked to see what had been studied regarding aluminum in babies, and I found this. This is a study with a very good design where 2-month-old infants received the usual 3 vaccines at once with 1,200 micrograms of aluminum. Urine was collected for 12 hours using a sticky bag for collection. Blood was also drawn at intervals. Dr. Moveses reported that there was no rise in blood or urinary aluminum over the study period. And then she said, "We were reassured to find no significant post-vaccine rise in serum aluminum level after vaccination of preterm infants with vaccines containing a total of 1,200 micrograms of aluminum." I wonder where she thought it went. I was stunned, and I asked Dr. Moveses if she was concerned that the aluminum was not excreted and blood levels did not rise. Obviously, the aluminum was retained in tissues. Her reply was, "So we don't really know what happens to the aluminum at this point in time. As you said, more research is needed in this area." She is aware that there's a problem because she referred me to Kahn's 2013 article that demonstrated tissue and brain delivery of intramuscularly injected aluminum. Aluminum is also injected into many babies on the day of birth in the hepatitis B vaccines. That's 250 micrograms of aluminum at a time when kidney function is even lower than it is at 2 months. As nephrologists, we have to study the immune system because the kidney is part of the immune system. We also deal with kidney transplants and therefore have to have a very good clinical grasp of the immune system maintenance as well as suppression in order to keep the transplant from rejecting. But what I was finding out about the immune system and injected aluminum went way beyond what I understood as a nephrologist. In today's talk, I'm only able to show you a very short list of aluminum's many known disruptions to life. Please see my short YouTube video called "Aluminum is Toxic to All Life Forms" for a further description. The question that arose fairly early for me was, why do doctors know next to nothing about what aluminum does inside the body? What other misinformation and gaping holes in knowledge do doctors have? And had anyone ever written about the problems with vaccination? Was I trailblazing, or were there physicians who had gone before me and had endured similar resistance? I was treated by the hospital administration as an outlier with radical and unwanted views. To my astonishment, close scrutiny of medical and vaccine history showed plenty of other outliers, not just Semmelweis and Oliver Wendell Holmes of puerperal fever infamy. When it comes to vaccination issues, it's useful to know about the following whistleblowers. The first outlier on my list is Sir Graham Wilson, who wrote a book called The Hazards of Immunization in 1967. Of course, I never knew of this book in my conventional years. Sir Graham Wilson was not a nobody, nor was he considered a quack. Though he does say that he was once totally ignorant, the book was a revelation, not just because of its content, but because of the fact that Sir Wilson was only able to write the book because of contributions from people that he mentions in the preface and the introduction. First, he talks about how the anti-vaccinationists he heard of were highly emotional and irrational people. But then he learned of an opposition that had sprung up amongst scientific workers who were moved by factual evidence. He thanks a former director from Wellcome Pharmaceutical Labs, Dr. R.A. O'Brien, who had amassed records of various vaccine disasters which he felt unable to cope with, and handed them over to Sir Graham, who said that it was doubtful whether the book would have been possible without those records. He mentions other people who helped him dig out long overlooked journals that were not obtainable elsewhere. This is what Roman and I had to do in order to write our book. So, how are practicing doctors supposed to know about vaccine problems if the literature is buried in basements and then books like Sir Graham's are tossed out from medical libraries? Sir Graham mentions a lecturer, a top health officer, who was totally ignorant of the long series of vaccine accidents in the late 1800s and early 1900s because of almost complete absence of information in textbooks. Sir Graham says the large majority of accidents have never been reported in print. Why not? He says for fear of compensation claims or of giving a weapon to the anti-vaccinationists. It's risky for any medical doctor to reveal unpublished material, but it's downright dangerous to talk as an industry scientist, which is also why R.A. O'Brien waited so long after his retirement to give Wellcome's disaster files to Sir Graham Wilson. Unfortunately, because most scientists never talk, the arrogance of ignorance is prevalent in academia as well. The same situation exists today, which is why medical students and doctors are in the dark. According to Sir Graham Wilson, there were many more reports of injury and death in soldiers from vaccines than any of us know about, because they are not mentioned in the medical literature, but remained hidden in the records of vaccine manufacturers. About the same time as Sir Graham was writing his book, a doctor by the name of Joseph Anthony Morris, who worked for the Division of Biological Standards in Bethesda, Maryland, was involved in an internal struggle which would later become the subject of a published Senate inquiry. This quote can be seen on the internet, but how many people know about Dr. Morris, who is undoubtedly one of the most important whistleblowers ever to have worked at the FDA? His work has considerable historic and medical significance. The uptake of the first influenza vaccine in 1945 was very poor. Dr. Morris was headhunted by the Division of Biological Standards because of the outstanding nature of his research skills. One of his jobs was evaluation of the safety and efficacy of the vaccines. However, Dr. Morris did not turn in results favorable to the flu vaccine. When he tested it on the Caroline Islands in different populations, he found that the effectiveness was anywhere between 0% and 40%. He reported to his superiors that the vaccines lacked potency and that the side effects were significant. To his astonishment, his superiors ignored those results and released the vaccines as safe and effective. This continued between 1963 and 1970. Dr. Morris was harassed, silenced, and demoted, forced to destroy thousands of lab animals and hand over all of his records. Publications of his results were blocked, his door lock was changed, the phone removed, and visitors were screened. Like today's Merck whistleblowers, Dr. Morris said that the DBS used dubious techniques to test the vaccines and that the results were tampered with, which permitted the watered-down vaccines to be falsely labeled as more potent than they were. Unhappy that he was unable to protect the public, Dr. Morris decided to take action. because he wasn't prepared to accept anything other than scientific fact, while his bosses ran interference to shore up the profits of drug companies, Dr. Morris hired a lawyer and went to the Senate. The result was a well-publicized hearing. In memoranda leading up to that hearing, it became obvious that other scientists were also harassed to the point where they were forced to leave the DBS. The Senate hearing, S-3419 in 1972, was conducted at the highest level, and vaccine irregularities were investigated. The hearing covered many topics raised by Dr. Morris, including SV40, flu vaccines, and the 32 useless vaccines listed here that were licensed and released by the DBS 20 years prior to this hearing. How these vaccines were made and what exactly was in them is anyone's guess. The information you see here was given to the Senate hearing by Dr. Peter Isaacson. Those vaccines, as a result of the hearing, were taken off the market. But Dr. Isaacson made a pertinent observation, that the 32 vaccines were known to cause serious side effects, and that the dollar value of vaccines sold was astronomical. Dr. Isaacson also noted, on page 349 of the public record, that physicians and scientists have a very marked discipline conceit and seem to think they can make all sorts of judgments on anything that is beyond their training. And before someone accuses me of doing the same, my comments today are based on years of real education, so that now I have what I talk about in my hand in black and white. The only reason we know about the vaccine issues in the congressional hearing in 1972 was because Dr. Toni Morris, who was about to be kicked out of the DBS for insisting that scientific principles and methods regarding vaccines be adhered to, decided to go public. According to sworn public testimony given in S-3419, memos were quietly exchanged inside the bureaucracy over dangerous vaccines and ineffective drugs. Yet nothing was done to protect the public. The Senate record also included statements from other harassed DBS scientists who had less courage than Dr. Morris, but were still prepared to give evidence to the Senate. The DBS tried but failed to fire Dr. Morris after legal challenge. As a result of the Senate hearing, the DBS was remodeled into what we know today as the FDA, and Dr. Morris was transferred there. Unfortunately, that change was just a cosmetic facelift. If you would like to listen to some videos of Dr. Morris from after he retired at the FDA, please go here. If you read the news today about whistleblowers from Merck and from the CDC, you can see that nothing has really changed. After his transfer to the FDA, influenza was still Dr. Morris's specialty. In February 1976, in Fort Dix, New Jersey, a swine flu strain was found in a soldier who died during a march. Dr. Morris was asked to help with the investigation at the same time that there was a manufactured scare over the possibility of another 1918 flu pandemic striking. But Dr. Morris found that the virus the soldier died with was just an ordinary pig virus, not a pandemic virus. It rarely infected person to person. He also found in prior years that the 1918 flu was caused by PR8, another strain of influenza that was discovered in Puerto Rico many years before. The vaccine that was created for swine flu was a hybrid between PR8 and swine flu. Why? Because they couldn't make a vaccine with that swine flu strain because it grew too slowly. So the slow-growing swine flu strain was hybridized with PR8, which meant the swine flu vaccine virus took on the fast-growing properties of the dangerous 1918 virus, and the viral antigen used in the swine flu vaccine wasn't the ordinary pig strain from the soldier, but a fast-growing hybrid. It turned out that the vaccine was both ineffective and unsafe. Again, his bosses wouldn't listen to him and told him to shut up. So he went on the Phil Donahue show and gave public lectures stating his findings. 40 million people were vaccinated. The injuries Dr. Morris predicted were a sad reality. Hundreds were reported to be paralyzed and dozens died. Guillain-Barré syndrome was a reality from the flu vaccines. The father of infectious disease epidemiology, Dr. Alexander Langmuir, confirmed that causation. By 1982, there were 1,571 lawsuits filed just for swine flu vaccine victims. This fiasco cost the government untold millions. The one thing they couldn't say was that Dr. Morris didn't try to warn anyone. The swine flu program was stopped, but not before 46 million doses of that vaccine was sold to the public. How people responded depended on their agendas. The organized crime underworld took Dr. Morris very seriously and saw an opportunity to change the power base of the mafia. Infamous mob boss Carlo Gambino took a flu shot just before he died. Apparently, someone from a rival mob heard one of Dr. Morris's lectures on the side effects. Knowing that Gambino had a heart problem, and having heard that the shot was potentially dangerous for such people, a Gambino insider was persuaded to convince Gambino to take the swine flu shot, which is widely believed to have pushed him into his grave. Make of that what you want. Many pro-vaccine people today consider the 1975 swine flu vaccine incident to be much ado about nothing. However, if you talk to older adults who lived in the cities where that vaccine was widely administered, you'll see that most of those people know of or have a family member that was affected by that vaccine. The third outlier whistleblower you should know about is Dr. Bernice Eddy, also mentioned in the Senate hearing about Dr. Morris. Dr. Eddy and Dr. Morris worked on the same floor of the National Institutes of Health and were colleagues and friends. You may have heard of her work in discovering problems with the Salk polio vaccine, but did you ever hear about the early adenovirus vaccines? At her memorial service, Dr. Morris said, "One of our shared interests was the fact that adenovirus vaccines were capable of producing tumors in animals." Pursuit of this work did not receive enthusiastic support from the NIH administrators. Every obstacle placed in the path of this work was, for Dr. Eddy, an obstacle to be overcome. The result was a discontinuance of the use of adenovirus vaccines in children. Dr. Eddy was the first to notice that Salk's polio vaccine after mass manufacture was paralyzing monkeys. Her report was ignored, and the result of that was the infamous and misnamed Cutter incident. But the story of the cancer virus is even more shocking. Because their kidneys turned out to be a convenient source of cells for growth and amplification of poliovirus, rhesus monkeys were imported to the United States by the millions for slaughter and experimentation through the 1950s and the 1960s. Dr. Eddy noticed that monkey kidney cell cultures would often degenerate spontaneously, even when kept under the most favorable conditions for cell survival. She suspected an unknown virus. In 1959, she skimmed cell-free liquid from the surface of monkey kidney cell cultures and injected that into newborn hamsters. Less than 4 months later, the majority, 70% of them, developed tumors. The experiment was repeated in generations of hamsters with the same results. Administrative clearance for publication of this important 1959 finding was not granted until scientists at Merck had recovered previously undetected virus in monkey kidney cell lines they were using to make polio vaccine. Samples of this virus were given to Dr. Eddy, who injected them into newborn hamsters and obtained identical results to those she had obtained in cell-free extracts 3 years earlier. She found that the virus induced sarcomas in hamsters not only at the subcutaneous injection site of viral inoculation, but also at a distance in the lungs and in the kidneys. When people think of polio vaccines in the 1950s, they think of the hero, Dr. Salk, and the miraculous vaccine, because the media made sure that that was how history would remember it. But from 1959 through 1961, government health officials were frantically seeking means to remove a tumor-inducing factor from polio vaccines. At the same time, these health officials were also vigorously conducting a campaign to inject contaminated polio vaccines into millions of people without telling them that it contained a tumor-inducing factor. That factor has been referred to today by one of the world's leading virologists as the perfect war machine. The Division of Biologic Standards used very similar silencing and intimidation tactics on Dr. Eddy as they did on Dr. Morris. Her laboratory was downsized and her staff was removed. She had to develop innovative and time-saving ways of completing her work. So she too was shut down for her findings instead of rewarded for potentially saving many innocent people from being injected with cancer viruses. Why is Dr. Eddie important to me? That monkey virus was called SV40. And today you can read in medical journals about the tumors and kidney diseases that have been associated with that cancer-inducing virus. SV40 is something that all nephrologists should know about, but for some reason they don't. SV40 is found in both healthy and sick people of all ages today. But people with a specific type of glomerular disease called focal and segmental glomerulosclerosis, or FSGS, which is very difficult to treat, are more likely to have SV40 in their kidneys. Ask any nephrologist about the toxic drugs used to treat FSGS and what the cure rate is, and how frustrating it is for doctors and patients alike. It is documented widely in medical literature that this kidney trophic virus came from polio vaccines in the 1950s and 1960s, and since then has been documented to circulate in the human population. Humans can pass it to each other, and we can also pass it to our children before birth. Nephrologists today don't know much about SV40 because they're interested more in two related polyomaviruses called BK and JC, which become active in people given a transplant who have their immune system suppressed. The possible role of SV40 in FSGS just doesn't come on their radar. But FSGS is a leading cause of idiopathic nephrotic syndrome, and most people with the disease eventually require dialysis. FSGS as a percent of the underlying disease among dialysis patients has increased 11-fold from 0.2% in 1980 to 2.3% in 2000. Just to give you a visual of what FSGS is, look at these images. A single kidney contains around 1 million nephrons, and each nephron has a filter. The circular images shown here are glomeruli, or filters in real life. They're spherically shaped. What you're looking at are stained cross-section images from human kidneys. The first one is normal, and the second and third ones show FSGS problems, which are obvious even to the untrained eye. The filters are not functioning properly, and proteins that should remain in the body leak out into the urine instead. Because of that, FSGS is associated with several other derangements in the body, like high blood pressure, edema, and lipid alterations. While SV40 virus is found in both healthy and sick people, it is known that a certain antigen from SV40 virus results in FSGS in experimental mice. We also know that human kidney is a reservoir of more than one strain of SV40 virus, and that people with kidney disease tend to have higher rates of SV40 viral shedding. This slide shows the rate of SV40 presence in urine and kidney of FSGS patients, patients with other kidney disease, and of normal healthy people. You can appreciate that the FSGS people have far higher rates of SV40 positivity. Just looking at urine excretion, you can see 41% of FSGS, 10% of other kidney disease, and only 4% of normals have SV40 positivity. Kidney biopsies, as previously shown, have the highest rates of infection in FSGS sufferers. We have seen a considerable increase in FSGS in kidneys between the 1970s and the late 1990s, which continues on today. Nephrologists see so much kidney injury from drugs like non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, antibiotics, chemotherapy, and in my and others' experience, even vaccines. Research in animals and humans shows that SV40 can initiate kidney injury and can also render kidneys susceptible to injury. Most people recover clinically after drug insults, but how many patients are susceptible to drug-induced kidney damage because they harbor variants of SV40 in the kidney? SV40 is also thought to reactivate as a result of kidney inflammation and with kidney injury from various toxins. This is an area of research that is largely untouched. Medical articles state that SV40 virus was in vaccines only up until 1963. But Rizzo and Carboni in 1999 showed that with better testing, SV40 could have been detected in seed stock for vaccine manufacture long after 1963. Attorney Stanley Copps in 2000 gave evidence from legal documents that there was no guarantee that SV40 was not in Letterly's polio vaccines up until the year 2000 when Copps wrote his article. FSGS, as we have just seen, is a serious potential consequence of SV40, but equally troubling is the potential for malignant kidney transformation in those who harbor SV40. Malignant transformation of normal cells infected with SV40 is a proven reality. Enders and Shine published in the 1960s that SV40 virus causes pathology and transforms human kidney cells in culture. That means that it causes disease and cancer in those cells. And Dr. Eddy showed that hamsters injected with SV40 developed kidney tumors. After 1964, the medical literature is devoid of SV40 kidney cancer research. But kidney cancers rose significantly after 1964. Look at this astonishing increase in incidence of kidney cancer in the UK. Similar trends are documented in Europe, Canada, and the USA. You may be saying, correlation doesn't equal causation. Certainly other cofactors may exist, but the research of Dr. Eddy and the finding that SV40 transforms human kidney cells is compelling. Causation was considered by Mortimer et al. In 1981 in a New England Journal of Medicine article, which summarized the results of the largest cohort of SV40 exposed children. Over 1,000 of those children were followed. They had actually traced 87% of that population of those children in 1981. Mortimer's concluding sentence says that because of mounting complexities and obstacles in tracing the subjects, cancer surveillance was terminated when they were teenagers. According to Dr. Anthony Morris, that would not have been the time to stop this study, but really to start it. Have vaccines anything to do with this trend we see as nephrologists? Because I can tell you, nephrologists and urologists have never been so busy, and business has never been so good as it is today. If you want to know why there are so many gaps in knowledge over SV40 and cancers, like kidney cancers, ask Drs. Key and Carboni. According to them and others, the controversy over the implications of SV40 damage has paralyzed the scientific research. Drs. Key and Carboni also said that SV40 was in Italy's polio vaccine supply up until 1999. Dr. Carboni expressed his thoughts about the suppression of his findings over SV40 and tumors in an interview to Bookchin and Schumacher. Unfortunately, as Drs. Eddy and Morris would tell you if they were here, you certainly can be punished for talking science, especially if it might make the public less willing to have blind faith in the safety of all vaccine programs. Let's look at another concern of mine. In order to make enough flu vaccine to vaccinate the world and do it quickly, a new way of making flu vaccines had to be developed. Making them on chick embryos, which is the old way, is too slow and time-consuming. So the new solution is Cocker Spaniel kidney cells, which were first cultured in 1958 by Maiden and Darby. Those same cells have become mysteriously immortalized. More recently, a sanitized term has been used, continuous cell lines. These cells are now deemed safe for human vaccine production. The FDA says nobody knows just how these cells were made immortal. I can only speculate, but the textbooks clearly state that an oncogenic transformation occurred and that there has been chromosomal mutation. This particular vaccine substrate just happens to be tumorigenic in humans, as stated by FDA personnel. These are screenshots from FDA documents stating that neoplastic Maiden Darby cells are used in flu vaccine production and that those cells may cause tumors in recipients. They say if the cell is not intact, it will not likely be a problem. But other FDA documents, such as PEDIN and the panel discussion among scientists in that paper, documents the real concerns discussed behind closed doors at FDA meetings regarding transferring even nanogram amounts of genetic material via injections. Tumorigenic Maiden Darby kidney cells are now used to make flu vaccines distributed in the USA, which brings me to the most recent whistleblowers. If anyone thinks hidden vaccine problems, like Dr. Morris reporting that the DBS lied about flu vaccine potency, DBS and Merck scientists finding SV40 and polio vaccines are all in the past, think again. Two of Merck's own scientists today are suing under the False Claims Act, saying that Merck lied about the potency of its mumps vaccine. The lawsuit documents list Merck's alleged efforts to defraud the United States through Merck's ongoing scheme to sell the government a mumps vaccine that is mislabeled, misbranded, adulterated, and falsely certified as having an efficacy rate that is significantly higher than it actually is. Merck allegedly did this from 2000 onwards in order to maintain its exclusive license to sell the MMR vaccine and keep its monopoly of the U.S. market. Merck attempted to have the case thrown out. It's pretty amazing when you think of the money and the medical and political power that Merck's lawyers have, yet not one of them could come up with an argument to convince the judge to dismiss the case. When you read the judgment, you get the feeling that Merck's lawyers really annoyed him. Science, in the world of Merck vaccines, could mean throwing out results that don't fit the desired outcome. It could mean throwing out evidence before the FDA comes to inspect. It could mean offering bonuses to scientists to deliver the necessary results. But what do you expect when you have the vaccine manufacturers in charge of proving that their own vaccine is potent? Science in the general vaccine research world includes placebos that are vaccines, or placebos that are carrier fluid with aluminum. Studies done on healthy people under optimal circumstances, and then those results are applied to everyone. Other outspoken journal reviewers and scientists admit that results favorable to the vaccines are built into the study designs. Anyone who has written a funding application knows that to receive money, you have to be pretty convinced that you can produce results that will enhance the aims and objectives of the financier. I knew none of this as a nephrologist, because the system makes sure that medical students don't even think to look for information that might warn them that not all is well with these one-size-fits-all vaccines. Yet that information is right under their eyes if they only knew where to look. Of course, the CDC and FDA would prefer that we all just relax and believe the authorities are looking out for us. When is the ignored science going to be taken seriously? It never will, so long as people who talk about problems are called outliers and then hounded, vilified, character assassinated, and said to have psychological problems. Another area that bothered me was, why do my patients not show the same side effects as each other? Why do vaccines seem to be tolerated by some people, and for others it can be devastating? Why do some adverse effects happen immediately, and others take weeks or months to fully appear? This bothered me greatly, because the vaccine program is a one-size-fits-all operation. The hospital gave vaccines routinely, no matter what, to anyone who consented. However, in my research, I came across a very interesting study which opened my eyes to the fact that the individual uniqueness has been totally left out of the vaccine effect equation. In 2013, Dr. Orntoff published research detailing the genetic network changes in white blood cells before and then 6 weeks after DTP booster vaccination in 8 different girls. Here's a list of the top networks altered after the vaccine, and they're listed according to their significance. The reason this study was undertaken was that DTP shots in African studies have increased the short-term death rate in vaccinees. You can probably appreciate that there's a big difference in the array of changes between these girls and why one-size-fits-all vaccination programs cannot be acceptable across the board. What this study proves is that after a vaccine, you're not just going to get a fever, good DTP immunity, and a sore arm, because different genes are activated in different people. And remember, these are just the genes measured in some white blood cells and not in the whole body. Looking at a more clear slide, this is a partial list of the top genetic networks that are altered in the 8 girls after vaccination with those DTP shots. Here's another study showing how many undesirable gene networks can become active after vaccination. This was a human study where five infants got the usual first two sets of vaccines at 3 and 5 months. Then they had their blood drawn at 6 months. Those blood cells were re-stimulated with pertussis toxin, which is a component in the DPT vaccines. The following results were noted: allergy, asthma, cancer, and immunological disease genes were upregulated. If you want to know what the immunological explanation is for the gene changes that happen after DTP and DTAP vaccines, I can't tell you, because as Dr. Orntoff said in 2013, they haven't studied it and they don't know. But if you want to follow common sense, you'll work on the principle that some gene expression changes might be an indicator of bad things to come, and the consequences of vaccination could be varied and potentially devastating. One very prominent vaccinologist, Gregory Poland from Mayo Clinic, who is also the editor-in-chief of Elsevier's journal Vaccine, has published widely. He states that the genes upregulated for an immune response are myriad, and activation patterns differ significantly between people after vaccination. The current vaccine program, according to Dr. Poland, does not allow an informed understanding of an individual's genetically determined risk for an adverse effect due to a vaccine. He's also known for saying how the current MMR vaccine is significantly troubled by primary and secondary vaccine failure, and therefore eradication under its use is not possible. He wants to develop the next generation of vaccines to try to incite a more thorough and reliable immune response to measles in very young babies. Dr. Olivia White et al. States in the journal Vaccine that vaccine side effects are more likely to involve aberrant cell-mediated immune responses. And the best testing to look at cell-mediated immunity as a measure of vaccine side effects is available, but not required or routinely used as part of safety or immunogenicity testing. Dr. White described how complicated the immune system is. The cellular and humoral immune response involves many different cell lines and communication networks within the immune system. And specific immune responses involve the coordinate activation of hundreds to thousands of genes. Dr. Kimmon corroborates Poland, White, Orntoft, and others, who states that the immune response is highly complicated and variable from person to person. Kimmon speaks to the likelihood that vaccine non-responders are also those who are more likely to be susceptible to the worst form of disease. What this means in practice is that healthy children who do respond to vaccines are the ones who would have had a good prognosis and have recovered uneventfully. Poland's research can determine the genetics involved in both vaccine antibody response and disease prognosis. But he cannot mention the implication of that, which is that the majority of parents are vaccinating their healthy children for diseases they would easily have recovered from with no complications. Nor can he tell parents that the children who do not respond well to the vaccine are the ones who will have the worst time with the disease. Individual variation is very clearly seen in kidney patients because their immune systems are much more fragile than healthy people. As nephrologists, we often land up giving dialysis patients numerous high-dose hepatitis B vaccines. Many of our patients do not develop antibodies because their immune systems don't work properly. Some of those dialysis patients got really annoyed when the antibody tests showed no response, because then they're given so many injections. Yet we can't even guarantee that these patients with no antibodies won't get the disease after they're vaccinated numerous times. Did vaccines contribute to my patients' temporally related issues because different genes got up or down regulated, just like the children who are vaccinated? Do we have any studies to show that over periods of days, weeks, or months, this is not a risk? No. But we do have genetic studies and clinical case reports that show it is possible. I believe that the kind of study Orntoff did on the children should also be done on healthy people to see whether routine vaccines are a trigger for acute kidney disease, and on kidney patients as well. I believe that clinicians should have access to such testing because patients deserve better care and better answers when policy results in unintended consequences for them. There's absolutely no doubt that vaccines are big business. This man that I mentioned earlier, Gregory Poland, is one of the most widely quoted pro-vaccine researchers. He's a professor of medicine and researcher and a motivational speaker at Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. He's also editor-in-chief of Vaccine Medical Journal. He's a man who knows a lot more about vaccines than he lets on. But what's most important to him is maximum use of current vaccines, until his research gets to the stage where his vaccine patents will come into force. Poland calls this a new golden era of personalized predictive vaccinology, where we abandon the one-size-fits-all approach. However, another new era of vaccine development was predicted a long time ago. The first mention of vaccine riches ironically came from the pen of the World Health Organization in a 1998 newsletter that startled me in its outright admissions. It said that new microbes inflict new syndromes in different populations. And while it is bad for those people, it's good news for the Global Program for Vaccines and Immunization employees. And that business is good and that their jobs will not likely disappear. Did you know that the World Health Organization is a business? Add to that the more recent published medical journal literature in Lancet and elsewhere showing that the World Health Organization does not often base its recommendations on evidence and that there are huge conflicts of interest between their consultants and drug companies. For me, medicine was once a business too, and it was very good and lots of fun to have all that money in the years that I did. But the love of money can rip away at honesty, decency, and indeed life itself. In 1998, the World Health Organization published an update of their 1993 Children's Vaccine Initiative Plan. Here are some targets outlined in the book. Does this look to you like the mandates from an independent organization or a promoter of a business? Some people might say, well, so what? It's smart to have a business plan. But it's not what's in this book that's the main problem. The main problem is what's left out of this book. Where are the voices of the consumers whose kids became another statistic? Or those who want facts to make a decision? The World Health Organization still isn't on top of the expanded program on immunization's unsafe syringe issues. For years, used vaccine syringes have mysteriously spread through the African black market. Other World Health Organization documents regarding unsafe injections state that these black market syringes have been responsible for widespread hepatitis B and HIV infections in undeveloped countries. Yet, the World Health Organization commit to twisting politicians' arms, parents' arms, co-opting mothers to advertise, and creating a climate of maximum vaccine acceptance and use, which by default makes criminals of all those who don't want to vaccinate their children. Today, in 2015, this looks like it's already happened. In 2015, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services pretty much took the 1997 World Health Organization book and mirrored that for adults. This is a plan that has been a long time in the making, and we're just getting to see the real nuts and bolts. Notice the goals here, also described as targets in the document. Today's climate is all about creating a culture of compliance. Anything outside that mandate isn't on the table for discussion. So what then happens to dissenters, public or medical? Doctors are humiliated, alienated, attacked, and called dangerous, incompetent quacks simply for criticizing mandatory vaccination, even when, like me, they were highly respected in their careers in conventional medicine. Doctors who see things that make them lose sleep rarely risk everything and speak. Some, like recent CDC whistleblower, Dr. William Thompson, after decades of compliance with CDC insider policy, do speak. When Paul Offit was asked what he thought of this highly published veteran CDC scientist coming forward, his response was that Dr. Thompson must have psychological problems. Apparently, anyone who states anything potentially damning about vaccines, whether well-founded or not, is crazy, fraudulent, or a quack. Whether or not they are neurosurgeons, radiologists, Rockefeller-trained immunologists, Harvard vaccinologists, or pediatricians with decades of experience. But you can see that it has long been government policy to stamp out any doubt about vaccine programs, whether well-founded or not. It was interesting that the CDC gave Dr. Thompson an award after he spoke out, and that he felt the need to say he was now focused on his job and family. It remains to be seen what, if anything, Dr. Thompson will do next, and whether the CDC is trying to buy his silence. That's how it works. They also tried to stop Dr. Bernice Eddy talking about SV40 by offering her a deal they thought she would not refuse, but that didn't work. Their actions against Dr. Morris backfired because his morals would not tolerate open fraud, and neither would he be silenced. Doctors like me were never taught that decades of testing, which showed the flu vaccine was rubbish, never saw the light of day. Today, the Cochrane writings on the ineffectiveness of the flu vaccine and Dr. Tom Jefferson's view that the flu vaccine is given as policy, not for scientific reasons, is little known. The information in Sir Graham Wilson's book never made it to medical libraries or medical doctors' consciousness. Not too many people realize that at its core, the World Health Organization is a business. Most doctors wouldn't see a vaccine reaction if it bit them in the nose. And if they see one, most just stick their heads in the sand. This is why families in America get such a rough deal and why there are so many sick kids. I am only one of 7,000 plus nephrologists in the United States. I don't believe I'm the only person who has seen numerous patients suffer after vaccines. I think I'm just one doctor who listened to what patients were saying and did my own in-depth research. Speaking out as a doctor today means you risk your medical license, your income, and your reputation. So it's logical that most doctors will not touch the issue of vaccination, even if they do see something wrong. If Dr. Eddy was shut down even when her published work showed that injecting polio vaccines into hamsters caused tumors from polyomaviruses, and polio vaccines into monkeys caused paralysis because the vaccine virus that was supposed to be dead was still alive, and if Dr. Morris, with all the evidence he had, was treated the way he was, who in my hospital administration would care what a clinical nephrologist has to say? The bottom line is that clinicians should never be responsible for proving either drug or vaccine safety, as I was asked to do. A clinician's job is their patients. I didn't want to do a study to prove what I saw with my own eyes under the stressful, oppressive conditions I was surrounded with. My time is now better spent voicing scientifically valid concerns regarding vaccine safety. The question is, what will it take for scientific integrity to become valued in medicine? When will medical doctors realize that they're mostly just high-paid, drug-dispensing technicians for a dangerous religion that depends on everyone being ignorant about information relevant to vaccines? As a nephrologist, I was belittled for daring to join a few dots for the benefit of my patients and had to go searching for this kind of information. Back in 2009, I didn't understand why the hospital administration was battling me when all I asked was to defer vaccination until the day of discharge. It wasn't until this year when a nurse in high-level administration told me the hospitals are not reimbursed for the entire admission if patients are not vaccinated in the first 24 hours or if there is not a detailed explanation as to why they were not vaccinated. When parents call me today and tell me they were treated harshly and thrown out of their doctor's office for refusing to allow up to 8 vaccines and numerous injections into their infants in one day, I usually ask them why they even go there in the first place. Why expose children to stress, to disease in the office, to medicine by numbers, algorithms to one-size-fits-all protocols delivered with a haughty disdain for choice, just to be told how their child is growing compared to the norm, and to be harassed into vaccinating. Most parents have no idea that between 25 and 80% of cases in measles outbreaks can come from medical centers. Most parents don't know that well child visits are linked to more than 700,000 subsequent flu-like illnesses, as per a 2014 report by Simmering. I suggest that parents find a health professional who can think laterally, independently, has many skills to offer, and who believes that parents bring something important to the table. The way things are going today with mandatory vaccines for everyone from cradle to grave, those doctors are going to be very busy. A 2000 report by the late Dr. Starfield revealed that every year, hospitals in the United States kill 225,000 people. Compare that to the average number of people who died from measles in the years before the measles vaccines. That number was 440. We're supposed to believe that all ended well with measles vaccines, so everyone today should just get vaccinated. We're not supposed to speak about the reality that what measles vaccines really did was take measles from the young children who handle it easiest and left the older kids, adults, and infants susceptible today, whereas those groups were protected in the pre-vaccine era. You're not supposed to know about primary or secondary vaccine failure. But the fact is that there are more susceptible people out there today because of the vaccine than there are because of vaccine refusal. And you're definitely not supposed to know that in 1963, the plan was to have measles eradicated by 1967, with a fantastic one-dose regimen given to just part of the childhood population. The fact is that the early measles vaccinologists had no idea that the measles vaccine would be so ineffective and its protection so short-lived, because they hypothesized that just one shot would confer lifelong immunity, just like the natural virus does. Well, they were dead wrong. But getting back to the real risks today, shouldn't Paul Offit, Arthur Kaplan, Dart Rice, and Jimmy Kimmel all be screaming about the danger of hospitals and rushing to save the victims of inpatient and outpatient treatment? Apparently, when the medical system kills or maims a person, it is accepted, expected, forgivable, and forgettable. Why am I doing what I do today? Because I saw something very wrong going on, and nobody would listen to scientific reason. Even if vaccines can protect for some diseases for a period of time in a lifespan, which is the best they really can claim, the assurances given to both sick and well people regarding safety and effectiveness is not backed by science, history, or even a significant portion of the scientific and immunologic literature. We have peer-reviewed writing that details the historical tragedies with vaccination campaigns. We have case reports of unexpected vaccine injury, and we know some of the mechanisms of vaccine injury. We have a list of highly educated whistleblowers who were harassed and silenced by government agencies for trying to protect the public from drugs and vaccines they knew were unsafe. We have prominent pro-vaccine vaccinologists today stating that pertussis, flu, and measles vaccines are failing, and that the problem is not just vaccine refusal, but those scientists' statements are ignored. My position is that vaccines are not guaranteed to be safe, that ongoing production problems do exist, that potentially dangerous foreign animal DNA and chemicals are in the vaccines, which don't reliably protect. The public is given a false sense of security over the safety and efficacy of vaccination, mostly because the study that would put this debate to rest has never been done. A fully vaccinated versus never vaccinated study on existing populations would be very informative. But there's no funding to do it on a large scale, even though enough children who were never vaccinated do exist. If the government and pharmaceutical companies are confident in vaccines, then why not just do it? There's no literature on the safety of vaccinating the kinds of sick people that I tried to protect. there is evidence that viruses from the 1950s were introduced into the human population via vaccination. Those viruses can and do cause cancer and are related to other medical problems as well. The attempts of scientists to look in depth at these issues have been sabotaged and discouraged. Today, we continue to have vaccines contaminated with animal viruses, such as porcine circovirus in rotavirus vaccines that third parties discovered and not the vaccine manufacturers. The problems are not just with vaccines, but as I later realized, are pervasive through a medical profession that is addicted to drug prescribing. Some of what conventional medicine offers is valuable and life-saving, but much of it isn't. Doctors and patients have a right to know all options available to them and what the risks are of any drug or vaccine. If conventional medical doctors are ever able to see the harm that their profession inflicts upon humanity, and if they are willing to take the risk of looking outside the walls of the ivory tower and look first at nutrition, the microbiome, and supporting the immune system as the true foundation of health and the prevention of most illness, they might have something worthwhile to offer. Every day, vaccine reactions happen, yet doctors won't report them and deny they exist. The very people who should speak the truth stay silent to protect their wallets, reputations, and practices. Their dishonesty betrays those they are supposed to protect. Vaccine-damaged families are treated so badly, and exemptions are under threat because policy matters more than honesty. What do you consider quackery? Upholding policy or being honest?